When you look at something such as a house or a vehicle, you obviously will see what is. To gain a complete understanding of that object, you need to know how it came to be and what it's been subjected to over time. That concept is what my next guest in his new book has done regarding one of the cornerstones of freedom and liberty in America, the First Amendment. His presentation includes the history of the First Amendment, its role in America in court cases which have either strengthened or challenged it. He knows of what he speaks and has written, given his role as a First Amendment attorney, who has been at the forefront with many First Amendment issues, most recently the Supreme Court ruling on Citizens United. He's senior counsel with the law firm Cahill, Gordon & Reindel. His book is The Soul of the First Amendment. Floyd Abrams, thanks for being here today, sir.
Oh, it's good to be here.
And for those listening who maybe have been without a civics class for a few decades, let me give you a kind reminder of the First Amendment. It goes as follows. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of a religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. So with that being laid before the ears of people listening to us right now, Mr. Abrams, if you remove the phrase Congress shall make no law, what does that do to the First Amendment?
Well, first of all, you know, the word Congress, the word Congress has been expanded through the years to include the executive branch and cities and towns and the like. But if you took that out, you would be avoiding, really overcoming the core of the Bill of Rights and the core of the First Amendment, which is a concern about government. It's a concern about government getting too close, having too much power to deal with these most sensitive areas, religion, free speech, free press. And if you took out the Congress shall not and simply said the public shall have the right to do this, I think it would have been interpreted very differently and much more narrowly, you know, even beyond narrowness, it might well have been interpreted to just be an admonition. You really shouldn't do this instead of law. Because one of the great things about the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment in particular is that it's not poetry. It's law. Judges enforce it. And by enforcing it, they protect us.
I was just going to say, those few words keep it from going from the concrete to the abstract.
Yes. Yes, very, very, very well said. 45 words in the entirety of the First Amendment, and we built this whole edifice of protection based on it.
And surprisingly, as you reveal in the soul, or remind us really, being that it's history of the soul of the First Amendment, there were those at the Constitutional Convention who didn't see this as a priority and didn't even think this something like this needed to be included.
Absolutely. In fact, there was a vote of the states at the convention in Philadelphia at which the Constitution was written, and the vote was 10-0 against having a Bill of Rights. It wasn't because they didn't believe in free speech or freedom of religion. They didn't think it was necessary or useful to include a Bill of Rights, and it took the really strong advocacy of people like Thomas Jefferson, you know, saying in almost these words, I won't support the Constitution unless you attach a Bill of Rights that makes it clear and unambiguous that there are many things that the government cannot do.
Now, people will, again, be reminded of those words that government is basically hands-off by original intent, and we can go into some of the attempts to reinterpret over the centuries that the First Amendment has been subjected to. But I can imagine someone right now listening, certainly who's listening to the show, because these are a couple of topics we've talked about, In the here and now, a pastor can't, I guess you'd say, politicize from the pulpit, yet the Westboro Baptist Church can denigrate a military veteran at their own funeral. Explain that one to someone who's trying to understand the First Amendment.
Well, it's a very good question. A pastor can proselytize, but can't get a tax exemption if there's, you know, the equivalent of political talk from the pulpit. My reaction has, for some time, has been that that's a very likely unconstitutional restriction. And I think come the day that the Supreme Court gets to hear that case, and it's never been brought up, that chances are pretty good that they will strike it down. In part not only, but because of the very question that you ask. I mean, we protect the Westboro Baptist Church for saying these outrageous, vile things about American soldiers who've been killed in action in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we do it, and we're alone in the world in doing it, by the way. I mean, Canada wouldn't protect it. England wouldn't protect it. I mean, great democracies, we go much farther in protecting free speech than any country in the world. But in this area that you point to in terms of effective limitations on what can be said from the pulpit, we press very hard against free speech in an area where it should be most important.
Attorney Floyd Abrams, his new book, The Soul of the First Amendment, here on Issues and Ideas. What was one of the most precarious challenges ever thrown at the First Amendment? What one court case really stands out as, if it went the other way, something really different would have resulted?
I would say two very recent cases, both involving the New York Times. One case called New York Times against Sullivan, which was a libel case brought in Alabama by a sheriff of the Birmingham jail at the time of the jailing of Dr. Martin Luther King. And at that time, white Southern juries were imposing enormous judgments against national publications and the like when they effectively wrote about the civil rights revolution of the 1960s. And if the Supreme Court had allowed judgments against these publications to stand, they very well might not have stayed in business. And the other one is a case I worked on for the New York Times, the Pentagon Papers case, where the government was rebuffed, the Nixon administration, in trying to prevent the New York Times and other newspapers from publishing information from a secret study about how the U.S. became involved in the war in Vietnam. I mean, that, too, is a case which laid down with great clarity the near impossibility of the government getting a prior restraint, a court order against publication of materials that it thought shouldn't be published. And there, too, it was an enormous victory, and a loss would have been even more enormous.
Is it correct to think of free speech in the First Amendment as, maybe the analogy would be, a field without fences, or does the First Amendment and this freedom come with common sense responsibilities that in the here and now people try to push to the side because it's something that's an element they don't agree with?
Well, the First Amendment is not absolute, even though the language, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech or of the press, sounds it. It's never been interpreted to bar having, you know, libel suits or privacy suits. It's never been interpreted to protect spying, even though it's words that are spoken in the course of spying. There has been or perjury prosecutions. People lie under oath. That's words. It's speech. But the courts basically say, well, that's not. That couldn't have been. And it wasn't what the people who drafted the First Amendment had in mind. So there are lots of examples of speech of one sort or another that are limited. And there are whole categories of people who have fewer rights, people in the army, people in prison, students in a public elementary school. I mean, we're not crazy, you know. We don't say everybody can say anything everywhere, but it is still the broadest level of freedom of speech and press that the world's ever seen.
And there is a reason why the founders did make it first in the batting order in the Bill of Rights. And what Mr. Abrams does, he comes through to you with a book of academia that you, as a layperson, because it is based in history and fact, it'll give you a better understanding. It'll make you become interested and more concerned about the risk some people try to place what is one of our foundation cornerstones at, and even in the here and now, it could still be attacked. But the strength of facts and the strength of purpose can overcome any attacks, as we've seen, as Mr. Abrams points out, in the soul of the First Amendment. He is also part of the law firm, senior counsel with Cahill, Gordon, and Rindell. Their website is cahill.com. Mr. Abrams, thanks so much for holding up history for us to be reminded of and to even learn more about, and thanks for being here today.
Thank you very much.